Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Hello, everyone. My name is Harvey Brownstone, and today you're going to meet a jollytologist. What, you ask, is a jollytologist? Well, you're about to find out. Our guest had a successful career as a scenic designer on TV shows like Merv Griffin, Jackie Gleason, and Captain Kangaroo. He then became a best-selling author of 29 books, including The Healing Power of Humor, Embracing Life After Loss, and The Awe Factor. He's also a well-known motivational speaker and has won a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor. His name is Alan Klein. Alan, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. You know, you said I'm a jollytologist, so why don't we start with a little jolliness?
What is a jollytologist, Alan?
Well, Harvey, guess what? I made it up. I believe you can be whatever you want in this lifetime. And so I actually went to school to get a master's degree in humor. It was actually a master's in human, H-U-M-A-N development. And my thesis was about humor and laughter.
You had a successful career as a scenic designer. What made you decide to change paths and become an author and motivational speaker?
Well, you know, life, you go in one direction and then all of a sudden life takes you in another one. Basically, I was working for CBS television for 10 years and the shows that I was working on, one of them moved to Hollywood and I was in New York and another one moved to Florida and I was in New York and they didn't take their designers. And so they gave me like soap operas to do, and I didn't want to do that. So I left CBS, and my wife was from San Francisco, and I always said, I want to live in San Francisco. I want a Victorian house. What happened in New York, I had a rent-controlled apartment. The landlord was trying to get us out and gave us this big pile of money, and I said to my wife, okay, let's take the money and run. And we moved to San Francisco. And then after about 3 years here, I think it was, she became very ill. And after she passed away, I thought, you know, what am I going to do with my life? And so I had a business at the time in silk screening in the city. And I thought, you know, I'm being called to do something else. I didn't know what it was. And so I became a hospice volunteer, a home health care aide. And I would notice how people would often use humor to help them rise above the situation. Sometimes, Harvey, it was sarcastic humor, cynical humor, but it helped them cope. And so I left, I sold the business to my partner and went back to school to learn about death and dying and therapeutic humor. And got a master's degree in it and wrote The Healing Power of Humor.
You are a strong proponent of the concept that humor and laughter have a healing component. You wrote The Healing Power of Humor in 1989 after your wife passed away, as you've just explained to us, from a terminal illness. I'm so sorry to hear that. Can you explain the process that you went through to actually write the book?
Well, first I will say there were lots of tears, but there was also laughter. And even after she died, my daughter and I would always like, you know, what would mommy do? Or what would mommy say here? And we would start to laugh. And so I needed to share, and it would help me even just momentarily. I remember Ellen had a copy of Playgirl magazine at the Male New Centerfold, and she said, Alan, I really like this nude man this month. Can you put it on the wall by the bed over there? And I said, Ellen, the hospital, it's a little risque for that. And she said, well, so maybe you're right. Why don't you get a leaf from the plant over there and cover up that part? And I did that for, one day it was fine, second day it was fine, but the third day the leaves start shriveling up and we would start to laugh. And I realized, Harvey, that little laughter, maybe 10, 20 seconds, helped us rise above the situation, gave us a reprieve, and gave us that perspective that humor always gives you in a difficult situation. And so I wanted to share that with the world. I had this passion to share it. And so I started to write the book. And I also became a professional speaker to do keynote speeches and workshops about therapeutic humor. So it was a great passion of mine to share that message with people. And it's still, apparently, has reached an audience. It's now the book's now in a 40-plus printing and a ninth foreign language.
Do you get fan mail from readers?
I do. I get people who say, like, the words in my book has really helped them. One example I'll give you, one woman said when she was a teenager, she was molested. And she said she had never told anyone that. And this woman is now in her 70s. And she said, I never told anyone about that. And then she said, I read your book. I took back my courage. I now am able to share that with other people. And I can't tell you how much your book has meant to me.
So the book, in terms of its impact, has gone way beyond what even you anticipated.
Right. Yeah. I mean, so people all over the world have read this book and hopefully have gotten something out of it. And yeah, I do get, and particularly in when I was doing my keynote speeches, people would line up to tell me how, my son, for instance, my son was murdered 2 years ago, and I have not had a laugh until today. Thank you so much for coming, and talking to us. Things like that. So yeah, when I'm writing, Harvey, it's not easy. I don't know. Have you written any books?
Yes, I wrote one.
Okay, so it's a chore. It's you have to sit down and think and write it and edit and edit, and so it takes a long time. It's not an easy process. But I realize when I'm going through it, if this whatever I'm writing, if it could help one person, then I have done my job. Because the world is pretty serious now. And so, whether it's I'm sharing about humor or getting on with their life after a loss or just realizing the amazing miracles and the awe moments that we have in our life, I'm always looking at how can I help uplift other people.
In 2019, you wrote another book that specifically deals with grief management, entitled Embracing Life After Loss. You give specific advice to people who are trying to recover from the loss of a loved one, and you write about hope, resilience, and embracing what life has to offer. What do you have to say to people out there, Alan, who are devastated by the death of a close family member?
First of all, I want people to know listening, I come from my own experience, my wife's death. And during the AIDS epidemic, I lost 40 friends. So, I have a little book where I have their picture and a remembrance of them. So and my parents have died, my grandparents have died. a lot of people, my sister-in-law, just a lot of people in my life. And what I ask people to realize is that death is part of life. None of us, it's been said, none of us will get out of this life alive. And, the moment you're born, you know that someday you will die. And it's not easy. I'm not saying, it's a laughing matter, but I also say that you cannot go on forever in grief. I remember I became a hospice volunteer after my wife died, and I was working with a young woman, probably in her 30s. Her mom had died, and for 2 years, she was severely in grief. And I realize after 2 years that two lives were lost. Her mother, who had died, and this young woman in her young, 30s, life had just stopped. You know, she didn't go out, she didn't do anything. And so at some point, I'm not saying forget the person that died. I still remember my life. I still talk about her with my daughter. It's not that we've forgotten her. It's just, how would she want us to go on? When I was writing my book, I asked people, how would you want your loved one to remember you? And most of them would say, I want them to remember being, or to go on with my life being joyful and happy and enjoying what I'm doing and the people around me. So, if that's true, if the loved ones are saying, get on with your life, still remember me, but you can still enjoy life too. So that's basically what I tell people.
I think that's wonderful advice. I distinctly remember my mother, before she died, told me, I don't want you to grieve excessively for me. I had a wonderful life. I want you to go on and have a wonderful life. And it helped me enormously.
Right. Yeah. And so that's basically what I think people need to remember and take from my book. And the book, Embracing Life After Loss, it's laid out very simply, because when my wife died, after she died, I was severely depressed. And I would look for books that would help me get through that grief process. And what I found were these big, chunky books, 300 pages, telling me how I'm going to lose my appetite. I may lose my sleep. I may be depressed. And I thought to myself, this is crazy. I'm already, going through this. I know all these things. I needed some book that would lift me up, help me get through the day, having some words that would be encouraging to go on. And so that's why I wrote Embracing Life After Loss. It's just a really simple book that people could open up, find some uplifting quote, some of my words, and help them get through the day.
Alan, you recently released a book called The Awe Factor, How a Little Bit of Wonder Can Make a Big Difference in Your Life. Can you explain what it means to be awestruck and why you say that being awestruck is such a good thing?
More and more things are coming out about the importance of awe. Somebody just an hour before we're talking, was my former literary agent sent me an article from the New York Times of, I think it was 2 or 3 days ago, about the importance of awe, and particularly in this time of COVID. In writing the book, I kept looking at what is awe. And it's a very complicated emotion, which research has only been discovering it and writing about and researching it for the last 10 years. When I start looking at what it is, I found the dictionary had several definitions. One was being revered with fear and wonder. And I thought, fear? I didn't, for me, something always like the Niagara Falls or something like that. And yet, I remember when I was a young child and there was lightning and thunder, I would hide under the blanket because of fear. And yet that is certainly awe-inspiring. So that's one kind of definition. The researchers have another definition, which is that awe is something so vast that it changes our understanding of who we are in the world. And so then I start looking, that's a little complicated for me. And when I start interviewing people and looking at my own moments of awe in my life, I realized they were things that like knocked my socks off, that took my breath away, that gave me goosebumps, or times when I said, oh my God, I couldn't understand how something like that happened. So I came up with my own simple definition. And it's an acronym based on the word awe, A-W-E, stands for a wow experience. Whenever you go, wow, you've come across something that has awed you. So that's my simple little explanation of what awe is. And then why is it important? Well, it's all about the new research. And just last September, research came out about the importance of taking an awe walk. And very simply, what they did is they took two groups of people, 52 people each, mostly older people, 60, 70, and 80. They chose that group because this is a group that often is down or depressed or upset. And they told that both groups go out and take a walk one day a week, 15 minutes a day, and the experiment went for 8 weeks. That's both groups were told that, but the second group were pulled aside and added one other direction, and that was when they're on their walk for 15 minutes to look for something that awed them, that astounded them, that amazed them, and just notice how they felt. And there were a couple of other little prompts that they gave them. And then when they came back, they interviewed those people. And what they found is the group that were not told to find some awe said things like, I was concerned about stuff and thinking about negative stuff. And one woman said, I'm going on a trip in a couple of days and I'm not packed and I haven't bought the stuff I need to buy. And she was worried about stuff that haven't even happened yet. The other group, on the other hand, said they had less negative emotion, more positive emotion, and that compared to the other group, they were much happier. So all of these scientists are finding new research that awe is an incredibly powerful emotion. One example of a research found that it could help us lower blood pressure was one, inflammation. It can help lower inflammation. I thought that was remarkable. It could help us be closer to other people. One result after another showing how powerful finding awe can be. And they said, you know, you don't even have to go into nature. Nature's the biggest thing that could help us get more in our life, but if you just had a photo of some nature scene that previously brought you some awe, just looking at that photo could help bring those moments back again.
Last year, you published a book called The Joy of Simplicity, Insights to Unclutter and Uncomplicate Your Life. You wrote that joy is simply a matter of choice and that we should just let go of anything in our life that causes us stress or unhappiness. Isn't that easier said than done?
Yes and no. You know, I think life, if you ask me the one word in life that I would say changes everything, it's choice. Because no matter what happens, you have a choice of how you're going to react to it. It's not the traffic jams you're in on the highway or in life. It's the choices you make about them. So like I always have bubbles and I blow bubbles in traffic jams to lighten up of the people around me. Other people could be fuming, you know, in their car or upset that they're late for work. Or another person could go, well, I may be late for a meeting, but I don't really want to go to that meeting anyhow. And they could see it differently. So it's the same situation, but it's your choice. So everything in your life is the choice of how you're going to see it.
When I read that book, The Joy of Simplicity, it seemed to me that you had three messages there. Go with the flow, focus on what's important, and slow down.
Yeah, slow down. And that ties very much into the awe factor. Because, you know, we're so rushed today. We're so full of the internet and, you know, multitasking with our cell phone and Facebook and Instagram and that we pass things. I notice people pass things on the street and don't even notice it. So one of my things is to slow down and look. And one of my examples is a couple of years ago, I went to Amsterdam during tulip time and I went to Keukenhof Gardens. Incredible. They plant 7 million bulbs. 7 million bulbs, most of them tulips because it's Holland. And so every turn that I kind of corner I went, I was like in awe. But then I start looking even closer. And the thing that really awed me the most was when I looked inside the tulip itself. And the patterns, the colors, sometimes it looked like lightning strikes with bright red or yellow centers. And it, so sometimes I think we just have to stop, look, and look even closer to find those kind of what I call magic moments, or those mini miracles that are all around us. But of course, we don't see them because we're so in a rush to get or do something.
You're also a strong believer in the power of expressing gratitude, aren't you?
Oh, yes. And I think, you know, it's so funny. After I wrote the book, someone said to me, aren't you really, the book about awe, aren't you really talking about gratitude? And I thought about that. And I thought, yes, because when we can stop and see the awe and stuff, we're kind of appreciating and stopping to kind of acknowledge it and in a way be grateful for that being in our life. But I think gratitude is one of the most powerful things we can do to improve our life. Because what we're doing is we're putting all that negative stuff behind us that stresses us out, and we're focusing on the things, the healthier things that can lift us up.
I agree.
I have been saying that the more I'm thankful for the things in my life, the more things come into my life for which I am thankful. That seems so true to me. When I'm grateful for something, just more of that flows into my life.
One of your books that I really love is called You Can't Ruin My Day. It contains a number of stories and situations that people went through, with commentaries about how they managed not to let those situations overwhelm and depress them. One of the stories is about a couple who lost almost all of their money to Bernie Madoff and his Ponzi scheme. Now, I have to tell you, Alan, that would definitely ruin not only my day, but probably my life.
Do you remember how they turned that around, how it didn't let them ruin their day?
Well, it was attitudinal.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's the situation. Yeah, I think actually my friend Matt Weinstein, that happened to him and his wife. And I think what he says is, yes, Bernie has taken all my money, but he can't take away my life. And I think that's the way he got through it. And they're doing fine right now.
I've known people who've had devastating financial losses, and it is quite a learning experience to reassess what really matters in one's life.
Right. Yeah. I've known people that have had fires too, and you know what they have left and what was not important. You know, we have so much in our life that's not important. I think choose wisely. I choose wisely what you say, what you, your attitude towards life, you know, how you, what you surround yourself with.
I watched your TEDx talk on YouTube where you spoke about our thoughts and intentions creating our reality. It sounds too good to be true that by simply wanting something and writing it down on paper, that it will actually come true. Is there more to it?
You know, all I can say is I've had that happen to me over and over and over again. You know, an intention, do they always work? No. Does it hurt to, you know, be positive and put those intentions out? If they don't work, what have you lost, you know? And the other thing is, sometimes I realize we put our intentions out thinking, oh, I want it to happen right away. So sometimes it's not quite the right time. Or maybe it's not the right thing for us. I believe there's a higher power, maybe, or I don't know what, some energy directing our life. So maybe it's not right for you at that time. Maybe it'll come later, maybe not at all. But Harvey, it doesn't hurt. There's nothing lost by keeping a positive attitude and putting your intention out of what you want in your life.
I have to say I agree 100%, because that is the exact approach I used in starting and promoting and pursuing this very show. And I really liked something else that you said in the TEDx talk. You said that we're all 6 degrees of separation from people who can help us achieve our goals. Now, I have found that to be true in my own life, that if I cast my net wide enough, I was able to find people who knew other people that could help me achieve whatever goal I was pursuing. It has really, really worked, especially with this show in terms of getting good guests.
Yeah, right. You know, and I have another, and some people may say this is silly, and I had a friend who said that, but I find lots of money on the street when I walk my dog.
You do?
Yes. A couple of years ago, I actually found a $100 bill in the gutter. So I find lots of money, and I add it up at the end of the year and to see how much I made a day, and sometimes it's 5 cents, and sometimes it's 50 cents, but... And then at the end of the year, I give it all to charity. But it's kind of a fun little thing. So one day I thought, well, I find a lot of money. I wonder if I can find in the next 24 hours a quarter, not a penny, not a dime, not a nickel. My intention was really specific. That's the other thing about intentions. You need to be as specific as you can. And so I thought, I want to find a quarter. So that afternoon, evening, I walked my dog. I didn't find any. But the next morning, which was in the 24 hours, I found a quarter. So I told this to a friend of mine. It was actually at a convention, a humor convention that it was at. And he said, malarkey, you know, that's ridiculous that you can intend to find money and find it. And I said, well, this is what I believe and this is what happens to me. And that was it. So the last day of the convention, he comes over to say goodbye and he says, close your eyes and hold out your palm. And I did. And he put something in there. I opened my eyes. It was a penny. I said, what is this? He said, well, after I left you, he said, I thought I'm going to try Alan's stupid little intention thing. I said, I want to find a penny. He said, a couple of hours later, there was a penny on the ground.
There you go. And I understand that if a person finds a dime, that is generally a sign that there's a loved one saying hello.
Really? Wow. Because not too long ago, I found like three dimes on the same walk. It was like that dime, next block, a dime, half a block later, a dime. Wow.
Yeah, that's that. If you research it, you'll see that is absolutely a sign that you had three guardian angels saying hello to you.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, thank you. I'll remember that.
Alan, I read that Jerry Lewis called you a noble and vital force watching over the human condition. Now that's quite an honor coming from him, isn't it?
It is. I'm so grateful, particularly because he usually doesn't give testimonials. And it was when I was writing my book, The Healing Power of Humor, I 6 degrees of separation. I don't know Jerry Lewis, although I've seen him when I worked in CBS television as a designer. He was there, you know, I've seen him once or twice in the hallways or rehearsing, but I don't know him personally, so I couldn't ask him. But a doctor friend of mine, while I was writing the book, mentioned that he knows Jerry Lewis pretty well. And so I said, could you ask him for, you know, some testimonial or quote about me in the book? And my friend said, you know, he never gives testimonials. He said, but I like your work. I like you. I'll ask him. And he sent back a note with that quote.
That's amazing. So, really, really
so
amazing.
Grateful.
And well-deserved. Yeah. I mean,
thank
Alan,
you.
you've published 30 books. That's astounding. How do you keep coming up with new ways to convey your message of positivity and optimism and good humor?
Usually when I'm writing one book, I get an idea for another. And also it's something that at the moment I'm passionate about. And so, you know, I wanted to share with the world about therapeutic humor during a difficult times, and that's how the healing power of humor came about. Wanted to share about lightening up after loss, and that's what embracing life after loss came about. You know, so each book had its little spark, I guess, of why I wrote it, and I just continue writing it because I want to share that message. Once I get that spark of passion, I want to share that message with the world.
You know, Alan, they say you can tell a lot about a person by the company they keep. I've noticed that the happiest and most well-adjusted people I know have made a point of eliminating toxic people from their lives, even if those people are family members. Do you agree that sometimes we have to cut people off in order to regain our sense of well-being in our own lives?
Totally, totally agree, and have done it. So I think, yes, you have to get some of these people or make it work for you. So yes, sometimes we just have to walk in the other direction and minimize those people or totally get them out of our life.
Sometimes the more successful you get in your life, the more you're surrounded by jealous people, envy. What do you say to people who've been disappointed by those around them who really were jealous and didn't wish them well?
Really interesting you bring that up, because I've had people that have said, oh, you wrote that book. I was ready to write that book. I wanted to write that book, you know, and what do I say to them? They didn't do it. You know, I sat down for 12 hours a day for 9 months to write the book, you know, that's what you had to do. And I'm sorry that you didn't write it, but I got there first. Again, it's a choice.
I've actually come to believe that the more successful you are, the more jealous people you're going to have around you. It's actually a badge of honor, because jealous people are never jealous of losers. They're only jealous of winners. So it comes with being a winner that you have jealousy around you, and you need to know how to eliminate those people who don't bring positive energy to you.
Yeah, I never thought of that, that it's kind of an honor in a way. They're honoring you by saying you're a winner. That's amazing. Yeah.
Now, as you know, the pandemic has caused a lot of grief for many people. Some people lost loved ones. Other people lost their jobs or their businesses. And family courts all over the world are swamped with couples who've separated due to the stress of the pandemic. Do you have any words of advice to people dealing with the aftermath of the pandemic?
Well, you know, we talked about staying positive and...
And choice.
And choice, yeah. So the choice and staying positive, and what I've done is, yes, you know, I've had friends die. I know people that were seriously ill. I know people that have split up. And the thing is, I think, to look for what... Yes, there's all those negative things, but what are the things that COVID, the pandemic, has brought that's more, you know, that lifts you up, that changed your life for the better? And so, like, for me, every day now since a year ago March, my daughter, who actually lives in the same city as I do, one of us calls the other at 5 o'clock to just chat. And it has been amazing. My daughter's asked me about my grandparents, you know, what I know about them. I asked her about cooking, and, you know, she's a gourmet cook. And we talk about what we've done each day and what we've accomplished or not accomplished and what joys have we encountered that day. And it has been, I've gotten so close. My daughter and I were very close before, but this has brought us so much closer. So things like that, and looking for the beauty, you know, the awe all around me, particularly because I was writing the book, that helped me do that. But just looking for the positive, the joy, the happiness that is still there. You know, just because there's the negative thing of the pandemic, the joyous things haven't disappeared. They're still there if we look for them.
Well, Alan, it's been a pleasure meeting you, and I want to thank you for the wisdom and encouragement and positivity you've provided in your books and in your presentations. And thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Thank you. It has been, should I say the word, awesome.
Our guest has been Jolly Tologist and author Alan Klein. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you to our producer, Steve Silver. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Be sure to check out more interviews by Harvey Brownstone on this podcast channel.
American Giant makes great clothing, t-shirts, jeans, and more, right here in the U.S., creating jobs in towns and cities across the country. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Save big money at Menards. Never get locked out from lost keys again. Menards carries a huge selection of electronic lock sets. Get a Truebolt touchscreen deadbolt that features one-touch locking and 50 programmable user codes. Available in matte black or satin nickel finishes on sale now through September 8th at Menards. America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. Visit jdpower.com for details and menards.com for deals.
Save.